Hi, everybody. Welcome to the lunchtime learning call for the month of February. Happy Valentine's Day to everybody. Today we're going to talk about debt collection, garnishment, and lots of other legal issues. I just want to remind everybody about this call series and how it works. These occur the second Monday of the month at 12 noon. And each time I present a topic, generally topics that have been suggested by folks out in the field. And we'll spend about an hour together on the call. I'll spend about the first 35, 40 minutes going over a brief. Those briefs are posted on the web. So we have a website, fyi.uwpx.edu/financial-series. And every month you'll find the materials for that month posted. These materials are basically a 4 or 5 page brief, sort of a 2-column brief to give you an overview of some of the the main issues that we'll be talking about. In addition, about a week after the call, there is an archive put up on that same website, so you can listen to the call, you can add it to a podcast, you can forward it to colleagues or whatever else. So at the very least, you don't have to bother trying to audio tape some of these calls. So this month, we're going to talk about debt collection and garnishment. Next month, we're going to talk about retirement rules of thumb. In April, we'll talk about behavioral economics, and we'll go sort of rolling on from there. And as always, I'm welcoming folks to propose topics that they may think are valuable for us to talk about as a team. Remember, this is different from the Building Bucks series, which occurs next week. Those are on the third Mondays, and we're back to our regular schedule again after the holiday last month. So Building Bucks is we cover the same 9 topics every year. We sort of update them as we go. And this month we're going to be talking about basic investment and savings. So that's next Monday at 1 o'clock. And those materials are and information about the series are at fyi.uwpx.edu/buildingbucks. So any questions before I get going? Okay, great. So hopefully everyone's had a chance to pull up the issue brief. This is 2011-2 issue brief on debt collection. That's essentially the material I'll talk about today on the call, and certainly would welcome your questions and comments as we go and at the end. I want to start this call, and I'll probably repeat this several times. I am trained as a consumer researcher and as a policy analyst and an economist. I've had one law class on international law probably 20 years ago, and maybe 10 years ago a real estate law class. So I by am no means a consumer attorney or have any expertise in the law. So what I'm trying to do here is just summarize some of the main issues that you may confront as you work as an educator and as you work with clients on particular issues. I would say this is definitely an area to be very cautious about. Any kinds of information that you give or advice that you give, because it is it gets into some very technical legal questions that most of us just aren't qualified to handle. The problem is that for most communities, we don't have great free legal assistance available. And so these questions come up, and sometimes the questions are simple enough that they can be answered. And so that was really the point of this particular brief, is to help you understand some of the issues that you may come across, have some of the facts. But again, I'll just put the caveat out here a couple times. I'm not an attorney, and none of this should be viewed as legal advice, and you certainly shouldn't be using it to provide legal advice either. And I also want to note on the Lunchtime Learning website, I did include a note with a link about the National Consumer Law Center. They have a book called Surviving Debt. If you buy a single copy, it's $20. If you buy multiple copies, it gets much cheaper. It has some really good resources in it. It's a great, if you find yourself getting calls or meeting the people about debt collection more than once a month or so, this is a good investment to make. The website includes more details about the book, and I even include an excerpt. They have a section called 16 Rules for Deciding What Debt to Pay First. It's a really nice resource, and certainly this brief reflects some of the material in there, but that book is several hundred pages, so it gets into a lot of detail on each of these topics, and I'd recommend that for further reading. So let's just talk generally about what we mean by debt collection. Debt collection can be on almost anything that's owed. So don't think just about loans. It could be a past due utility bill or phone bill or taxes, all kinds of things that are past due and are being collected on. So we use the term debt collection because there are things you owe, but it's not just loans. It could be a whole variety of different kinds of instruments that are being collected upon. And what you'll find, and you probably have found this in your own work, is that people who are facing debt collection are oftentimes facing debt collection of a variety of types. So it's not just that they owe credit card debt, it's they also have utility or mortgage or a number of others. So they tend to be multiple issues going on. Sometimes debt collection is triggered by a traumatic event, an illness, a divorce, some kind of problem in the family. And so certainly that is a dynamic that makes this topic even more challenging, because now you're not only dealing with financial issues, but non-financial issues. The point of all this summary for today is really just to talk about the particular issues related to how debt is collected. What are some of the rights and responsibilities that people have? What are some terms and definitions and how we go about this? I think this is a topic which has been growing in demand, in part because we're seeing record levels of debt being managed, being written off right now by financial institutions and by creditors, and also because of the recession and because of the other layoffs and the kinds of things that people are facing. We have more and more people who are in financial trouble than before. So again, this is sort of reviewing many of those kinds of issues and topics that you'll see. You know, the number one thing to remember about all this is that debt collection is triggered by somebody not paying a debt. Sometimes there's a legitimate reason that you don't pay something. You know, you have a contractor and they don't do the work, so you're not going to pay. You have a bill for something that you didn't buy and you still, you know, keep getting the bill for it. So there are sometimes legitimate reasons we don't pay. But by and large, those are issues that tend to get managed and tend to work their way out. And really, we're talking about here people who didn't pay either because they didn't have the money or they just weren't paying attention. And those are, you know, those are debts that are going to start to mount up with penalty fees, with, you know, particularly there might be interest or fees on top of late fees. And so they, you know, you start to really start to have problems compounded quickly. If you imagine a $100 credit card bill that you don't pay, they tack on a $39 late fee, and then they pay charge interest on the amount plus the late fee. You do that a couple months in a row, suddenly your $100 bill can easily become $200, $300, $400. So the amounts can certainly increase rapidly. And we see this with people who get into trouble on credit cards and other kinds of debt. There are lots of special categories of debt that I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on, but you know, medical debt is a special category, student loan debt, and then whether the student loan is federally supported or not federally supported, mortgage debt, you know, all these different kinds of debt have different terms and conditions. I'm going to speak more generally about consumer debt unless I for some reason, specifically say something else. By consumer debt, I mostly mean credit card debt, you know, sometimes auto loan debt, that kind of thing. So the most important thing now is once you miss some payments, what happens? And typically, whoever is servicing the debt means whoever is, you know, collecting the payments on behalf of the lender, posting them to some account, and then getting that money through the lender from you as the borrower to the lender, or to, you know, as the consumer who paid for something and have to make that go through. That servicer's job is to try to get that money paid. For most people, if you occasionally miss, they're pretty light-handed about this. They know that you might have forgotten because you were on vacation, or you just forgot, or, you know, maybe you had a little hiccup, but you'll get back on board. And so the collections efforts are relatively modest. If you're somebody who's frequently missed payments, your credit record is poor, or if after three or four payments you're non-responsive, then things start to escalate. And initially, the servicer or lender will directly get involved. They will work to try to collect payments from people, typically by phone calls, by letters. Those tend to be the main ways to try to make collections happen. If you're completely non-responsive, they might send people to your house, particularly for a larger item like a car or a mortgage. But generally, we're talking about phone calls and letters. At some point, the lender, the person who actually is owed the money in this case, will start to decide whether it's worth it to continue to pursue getting this money back or just sell off the debt. And what they'll do is they'll say, okay, I'm owed $1,000. I will just sell this to another company, a collections agency, for some amount less than that. I know if I continue to pursue this, I might get the money, but I'm only going to get $500 after all the costs and expenses of me trying to collect that money. So I'll just sell it for $500, so 50 cents on the dollar. And this is not uncommon, where debts get sold off to various parties. And they might get sold off multiple times. So some company might buy that debt, hope to collect 50 cents on the dollar, look at the debt, decide actually it's going to cost them more, so they sell it for, again, pennies on the dollar. So we can have debts transferred from one place to another. This is very confusing for consumers. Not only are they, so they got the loan from X bank, or they took the credit out with, you know, X company, and they have another company that serviced the loan on behalf of that lender, and then it got to collections, then it went to one collections agency, and then it went to a different collections agency. So you can see where people quickly get sort of baffled by exactly where does my check go, and who do I call, and who do I deal with, and you know, who what do I do here? So it can be quite confusing for a consumer perspective. The other thing that happens is that these debt collectors, especially as you get into the more aggressive phases of debt collection, really have a strong incentive to get as much as they can. So if they did pay 50 cents on the dollar, if they can get 60 cents, they start to make money. If they can get 70 cents, then they start to make real money. And so the more, you know, the more they can get without having to spend a lot of money to get it, the better off they are. So as a result, you get these robocalls and aggressive letters, and once they get people on the phone, they can be quite aggressive in trying to collect that money, scare people, you know, do anything they can to try to cheaply collect that money, as opposed to something more expensive, like come out to your house or do something more, sometimes more humane, so they want to try to get the money as cheaply as possible. Well, as a result, you have lots of folks who feel like they've been really abused by collections practices. And that's why we have a Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, which governs how collectors can behave. The trouble is a lot of people don't know that this act exists or that they have rights as consumers. And the fact that they you know, may owe money doesn't mean that they're a deadbeat who can be, you know, treated like such. They do have some rights. So some of the main things are that they the creditor can't use inappropriate or demeaning language. They can't call them names. They can't call them excessively, meaning they can't call them every hour or every 5 minutes or something like that. And they also have to keep their calls between 8 a.m. and 9 p.m. in general, unless they can show that somebody's on a second shift or something like that, and that another time is appropriate. You know, they can't threaten that they'll have you arrested. They can't threaten to, you know, get you fired. They can't say that they're an attorney if they're not an attorney, those kinds of things. So there are lots of tactics that we know that collectors do because they aren't afraid of getting caught because consumers don't report it. So this is one thing to think about as you work with clients, that if you hear these kinds of abusive practices, that people can take some action on that and try to get that at least that stress part of it reduced. Now, it is true that collectors can reach out to spouses and family to try to figure out where people are, especially people who've moved around. So there is some ability for them to do some limited contact with other parties, but they can't talk about, you know, your spouse or your kid owes a lot of money, or they can't, you know, get real specific about what the harms are, just that they're seeking to collect the debt and they're trying to find current contact information. That's sort of the limitation of how they're allowed to talk about that. You know, it is true that any third party listed in the account can be, so a co-signer or somebody else can be contacted. And they will even contact previous addresses if they're trying to find out your current address. So, but mainly the contact is around trying to figure out where you are to make connection with you. The way that debt collection works is that collectors are supposed to give written notice about what is owed, what the terms are, and what actions the consumer can take. And that notice is typically something that is sent by certified mail or some sort of mail that they can know whether it was received or not. And then there's this 30-day verification period where consumers have time to review that information and then can try to correct any incorrect information and try to deal with this debt directly. That's really an important period, and unfortunately, when you work with people, that period's probably already passed. Most people just ignored it. They thought it was yet another letter from their creditors and didn't try to take anything on. That's an important time because the law gives them some safe harbor to try to address any issues and come up with a plan, as well as correct any errors. Sometimes, in fact, often, some of the ways that the fees and other costs that have been lumped onto the initial amount owed aren't accurate. So it's a chance to try to fix some of those things before the collector gets into full collections mode. You know, the other thing is that the collector or servicer or the lender, you know, should be willing to provide lots of information during that time period, and less so in other time periods. I mean, in other time periods, it can get more antagonistic. So there is it's always antagonistic, but there is some reason to act more proactively in this period. Another issue we hear sometimes about collections is contacting lawyers. And it is true that collectors can contact employers. But again, under the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, it's limited to, you know, are you currently employed, and, you know, perhaps to verify the amount of earnings, although there has to be explicit reason for that. The other reason that a collection agency might talk to an employer is around a judgment or a garnishment, but we'll talk a bit more about that in just a minute. The next thing to think a bit about is if it does go to collections, how collections is treated. Most, it doesn't matter whether it's a loan, a credit card, and in fact, most purchases where you might owe, say, for a service or something else, typically the contracts include the terms of how collections is going to occur. And most people don't ever look at this because they don't think it's going to affect them, but it does. So suddenly they found out that, you know, if I miss a payment, the entire amount is due immediately. Or that if we have a dispute, we have to go to third-party arbitration, those kinds of things. So this is something where that fine print matters, whereas most of us don't pay much attention to that. It certainly kicks in at this point. So usually that contract talks about things like repossession. So typically if it's a good that has some resale value, there'll be repossession, so like a car, durable appliances, those kinds of things. And then the other option is garnishment. And we'll talk a bit more about garnishment. But basically, garnishment is where a creditor has the right to garnish wages or garnish bank accounts in order to get back the amount owed plus any of the fees, interest, and other actions that need to take place. Now, garnishment is no small step. It requires a judgment, which means it requires the courts. And the courts can actually can mandate other kinds of actions as well, including repossession and other kinds of activities. But I think the thing you'll see most as you look through credit reports or talk to people is our judgment. And judgments basically mean that you owe some amount of money and the collector has followed the rules to try to collect that money. You haven't paid up. And so now there's a judgment, legal judgment, using the courts that are placed upon the party. And the court can determine whether or not garnishment makes sense. And then the garnishee can then collect the money by either garnishing wages or garnishing accounts or garnishing property, those kinds of things. Typically, garnishment is a little bit different from repossession in that with repossession, there's some you go to the court to try to get the property back. And so usually you have a notice of default, which lets people know that they have some period of time to act. And then if they don't act, then the collector has the ability to go repossess the item. So cars are the place we see this most frequently. People will get the notice of default, and they won't do anything, and then the collector can repossess the car. And cars, as you know, are relatively easy to repossess. So they have wheels, and they're easily towed, and that will be that. Now, oftentimes, even with repossession, whether it's a car or something else, the amount that thing is doesn't cover the cost of the fees, and the debtor can still be on the hook for that, and that might then go to garnishment. So that might then be garnished from wages or from a savings account or a checking account, that kind of thing, from bank account. There are other kinds of actions that courts can take. One of those is a lien. Typically, we see a lien related to property, like a home, a lien might be a mechanic's lien where you didn't pay for some service done by a contractor of some sort. A tax lien where you didn't pay property taxes and now there's a tax lien on the property. So those kinds of things would result. That would actually mean in the public record where your title is, for the property is in the county court records, there would be a lien that would be against that. It would make it very difficult to sell that because it has to be settled before there can be some kind of transfer. A question you sometimes will get is, well, I didn't take out this debt. My spouse did, or my ex-spouse, or, you know, it happened before. But, you know, spouses are jointly liable, so it doesn't matter. Once after the divorce, then they're broken free, but still anything that happened during the marriage still counts. Another thing that can be confusing for some people is that they may have multiple debts, multiple things in collections with multiple collectors, and then some of them happen to be with the same collector. So they make a payment, and then the collector doesn't know which of the many things on which you still owe money it goes towards. So that can be sometimes a problem for people too. You know, one thing about the collections process is that collectors will oftentimes threaten legal action, but collectors don't have standing, legal standing, unless they actually purchase the debt from the lender. Only the lender can actually do that. Now, the collection agency can recommend it. They can have a process for starting it, but ultimately it's the creditor that files the lawsuit. And so unless the collector owns the debt outright, they can't actually go forward with it. So sometimes people will be scared by the collector, but really the collector doesn't have the power to do that kind of thing. A special category that I've heard from some of you about is utility bills, especially this time of year. You know, as you know, in the winter months of November 1st to April 15th in Wisconsin, you're not supposed to be able to disconnect people's utilities, although it turns out there are a number of exemptions that result in people getting their utilities cut off even during the moratorium period. And, of course, outside that moratorium period, if you don't pay, you get your utility cut off. So it's a pretty simple process. So if you owe before the moratorium starts, you can still get cut off. If you happen to have a utility service that is not covered by the Public Service Commission, so I think in a lot of in rural areas, the cooperatives are an example, they aren't required to operate under this. So there's, you know, there are a number of ways that utilities can still do cutoffs even in this time of year. And, you know, utilities, like any other debt, it can go to collections and everything else, but the fact that we can shut off your flow usually gets people to cooperate more quickly. Child support, I know you sometimes come across both people who are recipients of child support and who are payers of child support. Child support is a very particular kind of liability for people who owe child support, typically men, and that the court has already ordered a specific child support amount. This amount cannot be evaded. If circumstances change, the payer of child support can go back to the court and try to get a change. But not paying child support can actually result in imprisonment. This is a case where, you know, the only form of debtor's prison we still have left. If you don't pay child support, the court can order you to go to jail. So it's really a court-directed process and not something that people have much leeway to fiddle with without going back to the court. Talking a bit more about garnishment and how garnishment works, we call it garnishment means just taking a portion of earnings, of income, or of bank accounts to pay off debt. Typically, the court obviously is the party that starts, that actually will impose garnishment based on a request from the collector, or actually from the creditor, whoever the lender, owner of the debt is. The court can decide whether it should come out of wages or come out of bank accounts or some combination. And, you know, there could be garnishment for all kinds of different kinds of debt, including taxes and virtually any kind of debt that you can think of. There's a lot of confusion about what can be garnished and what can't be garnished. It is a complicated topic. I would say that the National Consumer Law Center book I have is helpful to some extent on this, but, you know, if somebody is facing a garnishment hearing, to go into that without legal representation might be a pretty big thing disadvantage, because you have to really understand how garnishment works and what can be garnished and what can't. Under the law, government benefits should not be garnished. You shouldn't be able to garnish people's disability income or Social Security income or those kinds of things. In practice, if those funds are deposited into a bank account and that bank account is garnished, then they can be garnished. And so you as the client have to make a case that the money in that account is actually collection proof, that it's federal benefits that should not be garnished, or public benefits that cannot be garnished. But most banks don't make that decision. They'll just respond to an order to freeze an account from the courts and freeze the account no matter what the source was. So while it's true that these payments shouldn't be garnished, it's still a big fear that people have because of the system of going through the bank accounts. Now, certainly at the garnishment hearing, people can argue, well, that account is only, you know, money that I've saved from my disability payments or something like that. But it is a big issue because you have to really show that that is the source of those funds. You know, banks typically will respond by freezing accounts. So it's not a case where you have a lot of flexibility once that happens. You know, in theory, anything that you deposit after the garnishment should be free, but again, they'll still sometimes freeze accounts because they just rather not be involved in some legal dispute. Typically, garnishment in terms of income would be 20% of earnings after subtracting off any public benefits and taxes. You know, the court really decides how much garnishment is going to be and who gets what, because oftentimes in garnishment there's multiple judgments. Child support generally takes first priority, then spousal support, and then other debts. If you have a client who goes through this process, they're going to get a notice of garnishment, and then they have to provide their answers to the court about what they are earning, what they have in accounts, what the sources are, and whether any of it is exempt. If they can't show that any of it is exempt, then the court is going to go ahead and proceed with the garnishment plan. You know, there certainly are some safeguards for lower income people in poverty. So if people are at the federal poverty level, which is obviously quite low, if they are on supplemental security income or SSI from Social Security, if they get food stamps or SNAP, and veterans are a special group in general. If you find a client who's a veteran, they have many more protections actually. So it'd be definitely one that would be looked at more carefully. You know, so anybody who's sort of getting public benefits and who qualifies at or below the federal poverty level should generally not have to face garnishment. Although again, the courts really ultimately decide how garnishment proceeds. Taxes are particularly important at this time of year, as people get tax refunds, and sometimes low-income people get relatively large tax refunds. And you know, one of the reasons why we know that some people avoid filing or don't claim things like the earned income tax credit is fear of garnishment, because the tax refund is something that courts can order be garnished before people can receive it. Now, I talked a little bit about people who pay child support, but also people who have garnishment or who owe debt may receive child support. And child support payments actually are treated by the court a little bit differently than earned income. And the child support will be considered sort of separately from other kinds of income in terms of how much the total amount of garnishment might be. Child support can be garnished, but it's, you know, typically not the first order of what the court's going to look at as they think about how garnishment's going to proceed. There's a list in the brief of various benefits that should not be garnished. Lots of different programs that are out there, including FEMA and other kinds of benefits that should not be garnished. Now, again, you know, once these things hit a bank account, it's up to the debtor to show that these amounts are collection proof, because they could still just be frozen, just like any other income in the account. And also remember, as I said before, there are certain categories of debt that are different. So child support, student loans, taxes, they can certainly look at lots of sources of income, including public benefits. So, you know, these are special categories of debt that that might still be garnished even if the income is generally collection-proof in another context. Bankruptcy, you know, obviously bankruptcy is its own topic, and so we have a little bit of information in this brief about bankruptcy. Hopefully you all know that there is the debtor education information on through extension that's offered. That's really thinking about how people emerge from bankruptcy, but still includes a lot of detail about how bankruptcy works and how people come out of bankruptcy. You know, the process of garnishment is considered in bankruptcy court, and sometimes courts can pause some forms of garnishment during the bankruptcy process, but, you know, unless that debt's extinguished by the court, typically there's still going to be some payment plan in place. And child support, spousal support is absolutely, you know, sort of not something that the bankruptcy courts are going to fiddle with or have the power to fiddle with, and typically are going to continue regardless of bankruptcy status. Another question we get sometimes is about the Fair Credit Reporting Act and how long do bad things stay on my credit record? And the general answer is 7 years. The bankruptcies can last for 10 years, but most other items like judgments, garnishment, those kinds of things are 7 years. That's 7 years from the date they start. So people can sometimes take years to deal with some of these issues, but from the starting date. Credit bureaus, the credit reporting agencies where these information is stored, don't always kick things off the record when 7 years rolls around. So it is something that consumers have to look at. And if you're reviewing credit reports with people, you might want to look at the date on some of the judgments and liens and these other kinds of negative events and see if they really should still be on the credit report. And if not, people can collect they can contact the credit bureau and try to get that changed, get that removed. Another question we sometimes get is around statute of limitations. How long can a creditor continue to pursue debt after it's not been paid? And so the answer is they can continue to try to get you to pay that forever. There's no limitation on them trying to get you to collect. What's limited is how long they can legally go to court and try to get you to pay. So the statute of limitation is on their ability to sue you to reclaim debts or to do garnishment or other kinds of action. Certain debt, you know, obviously student loans, any kind of taxes, child support, those things have no limitations that you can, they can always be, the government always has the right to go after those even if they're 50 years old. But at some point, most other debts become what we call time barred, meaning that, you know, people can't, the creditor or lender can't go after that particular kind of debt. It varies by the type of debt. For, you know, open accounts, it's about 6 years. Other kinds of judgments, it's up to 20 years. And in some cases, the collector or the lender can file again and have it extended. So the statute of limitations is not a tremendously strong harbor, as I understand, from continued collections. The collections calls can still happen, and you know, the court can still take action for at the minimum 6 years. If you find that you have a client who is getting active collections and feels like the collections are in violation of the protections that are afforded to them by the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, there are some ideas in some tips in the brief on page 4 about how people might handle that. You know, one thing that people will do is just stop answering the phone, and that's generally a bad strategy. Because you just never know, and it's not going to stop the calls. So ignoring the problem doesn't make it go away. So, you know, one thing is to continue to answer the phone and to be responsive. You know, one of the ways that people get into trouble is that they will get abusive with the collector. So oftentimes when there's a case of you know, somebody claiming that they were abused by the collector, they'll have an audio of the call, and it turns out, well, the collector was, you know, pretty patient for a long time listening to quite a lot of abuse from the borrower, from the client. So, you know, it's really important to remain calm, not argue, ask clarifying questions, but don't try to make it into a legal proceeding. Writing everything down, the time of the call, the date of the call, who called, what was the name of the collector, if they have a phone number, get all that information down. Try to get straight exactly how much is owed, how much is fees, how much is interest, sort of what are the terms, when does it have to be paid by, where does it get paid to. Write as much down and try to get as much information as possible. If it's a collection agency, then ask if the verification has happened yet, meaning they have to send you written confirmation about the debt and the terms. If verification has not happened, then they should do that immediately. You have 30 days to respond, and they should not be calling you in that 30-day period. The verification period does protect you from continued calls during that period. If there's no errors, then they can continue to go forward. What do you do if somebody feels like they're being abused by a collector? So there are a couple of phone numbers and resources listed in the brief. One is to contact the Federal Trade Commission, or FTC, and the website and the phone number for filing a complaint is listed. And at the state level, we have the Department of Financial Institutions, DFI, so their website and phone number is also listed, which might be helpful. I have a little bit of information in here about bankruptcy. Now, again, this is a topic that's covered elsewhere in extension at much more detail, but just to, you know, just remind you about how Chapter 7 works and Chapter 13 works. Chapter 7 is really what I think most people think of as bankruptcy, when they can actually have some debt forgiven. But oftentimes, you know, clients either can't qualify for Chapter 7, or they filed for bankruptcy recently, so they don't qualify for Chapter 7, or the kind of debts they have aren't subject to Chapter 7. They can't have them. They can't have a home mortgage or a student loan or spousal support or child support extinguished. So it is a tool. It might be useful for some people, but I think oftentimes what you get are clients who think that Chapter 7 is going to solve all their problems, and it's probably not. More likely, especially for people of more moderate and upper incomes, Chapter 13 is what is put forth. And generally, this just means a repayment plan. So it's definitely not going to relieve people from debt. It might help them from the collections for a short period of time and have it come up with a plan, but it's not as if debt's going to be completely written off.
Michael, this is Jennifer. I had a quick question about that. Don't they give you a reduced amount, though? Like, if somebody owes $80,000, can't the judge decide that you're going to pay 30% of that? Do you know how that works?
It's really up to the judge and the terms of the debt and how much of it is principal and how much of it is layered on.
Okay.
But it's not going to be as forgiving as Chapter 7, where you see, you know, actual liquidation of debt.
Okay, thanks.
The other thing that we see are Chapter 128 plan. Oh, and by the way, on any of these bankruptcy issues and what chapter to file and how to approach it, this is absolutely where a qualified bankruptcy counselor should be involved, which nobody in extension should be doing, because we're not certified by Department of Justice to do that, and typically an attorney. So this is definitely a place to be very careful. Another thing that we have in Wisconsin is what we call Chapter 128 plan. This is a sort of a state version of a debt consolidation plan. Typically, it's a three-year repayment plan that goes to the state courts. Typically, these are promoted by attorneys. I would say they are a potential option for people who are employed and are trying to manage their debts better. Typically, this is appropriate for somebody, say, who had a small business, say a contracting business, something like that, ran into a rough patch and is now trying to restructure. They could be pretty useful. The caution on this, like similarly that I might say on other debt management plans or debt settlement or even bankruptcy, is that the fees involved by the expert attorney or whoever is helping you do this can be high. So you want to really look hard at how much it's going to cost and, you know, how long are you going to have to be making payments, not just on the restructured debt, but on the fees for setting the particular plan up. I didn't talk at all in this particular brief about debt settlement, but debt settlement is a sort of relatively newcomer to the scene, which is, you know, these are companies that that aggressively advertise on late night TV, much like the credit counseling agencies, but are really going to try to work with you to go directly to each creditor and get them to settle for an amount owed. Those can particularly have high fees and should be treated with much caution. One thing that surprises some people when they have debt canceled is that canceled debt is income. If I owe $100,000 and my lender settles with me and I only owe now $80,000, I've just gotten $20,000 in income. And that income can be taxed. And so this is sort of a double whammy for people who, you know, they got into trouble, they're trying to work things out, and all of a sudden they owe taxes on this $20,000 of income, which they never really received as income. It was this debt that was forgiven. So this can be a very difficult situation for people to come into. What they will receive, and they will receive it right around now, is a 1099-C form, which is the form that comes from the creditor who owned the debt and relieved the debt. And that's an IRS informational form that gets filed. And that would be a signal that this is now considered income that has to be treated on the annual tax filing as income. Now, there are some safe harbors for people for debt forgiveness. The biggest one is the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act of 2007. That's only going to work for another year through 2012. But if it's for a home loan that was a principal residence, so it doesn't count for a summer home or something like that, or for an investor property, but if it was with a home where you lived and you had a short sale, or you had some kind of other reduction in principal, there is a safe harbor so that that is not a taxable event. The other safe harbor the IRS has, and it's really up to the taxpayer to make the case that this is true for them, is if they're essentially insolvent, if they took up all their assets, subtracted off all their debts, and their debts exceed their total assets, then they might be able to avoid the taxation of canceled debt. But it is definitely an issue that people are shocked about when they're in the situation and can end up owing yet another item that has to go into collections through the tax liability there. There's a number of websites that you can look at for more information, including information from the Bankruptcy Court. The Wisconsin State Law Library has information on how garnishment works. The National Consumer Law Center, and again, I have a link right on the website to on the Learning Links, Lunchtime Learning website, to the book that NCLC puts out, which I would, you know, again, if you deal with very many of these cases, it's a good book to have by your desk because it's just a good general handbook, and it's really designed for people doing counseling. FTC has a website that I would recommend on consumer issues. Credit counseling, you know, many of these issues, a credit counselor might be very useful because they can pull up, you know, while they're on the phone with people, pull up credit reports, and they'll know better about which types of debt are treated in each type of collection circumstance. They have a website called debtadvice.org that you can search for an organization, local organization, or you can call the 1-800 number. Credit counselors oftentimes are not, or almost always are not, legal advisors, so they will probably take you a little bit further, but fall short of legal advice. There is legal action, at least for the southern counties, and I list the phone number and the website there, and then the northern counties of Wisconsin, there's JudiCare, where clients can get some support. You know, I would just say it's you know, most people in the legal action or similar kinds of public service law are quite busy these days, and so it does require some persistence to get some service. But generally, they're very knowledgeable about issues like judgment and garnishment, foreclosure. These are you know, sort of bread and butter issues that they deal with quite frequently. And then last, in terms of utility cutoff, there's the phone number on the website for the Public Service Commission regarding utilities. And remember, cooperatives are maybe exempt, and then you have to think about the time of year. But that's another resource there as well. So with that, I'll just open it up if people have questions. I again, just would reiterate, I'm not an attorney, so don't take any of this as being legal advice. Anybody who's an attorney out there can probably correct much of what I said here today, but hopefully it gives you some sense of some of the terms and issues that are out there.
Michael?
Yeah.
I went to your link, and I can see where it says Lunchtime Learning and the Surviving Debt. but all I have is two paragraphs, and you're making it sound like this briefing has several pages. What am I doing wrong?
Click on the debt collection brief. It should be a blue.
Oh, yeah, the green file, the green box.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I knew it would be something simple.
Pull up the PDF, yeah.
Oh, it looks just great. Yep,
okay.
Thank you. Good information, thank you.
Sure, great, thanks. Any questions, any topics I glossed over or things you want more information on that I'd probably have to go dig a little bit on? Are people confronting these kinds of issues pretty regularly?
This is Jennifer. You know, this has come up as in the family financial team about a lot of the questions that we have that we are proposed to us that are clearly out of our area of expertise and certainly out of an area where we should be advising or counseling. And I think, though, it's important to be aware of these things. So if, you know, in the days when I did bankruptcy counseling, I would say, or if I have even now have a foreclosure client who's, you know, a bank has forgiven part of the loan, all I say is, you need to check with a certified public accountant because, you know, this every time a debt is forgiven, there could be ramifications. I mean, I'd have to say 99.9% of my clients never see that coming. And, of course, it's too late. I mean, they've already gone through the foreclosure process or that sort of thing. But I think just, you know, just to lead them to really seriously consider getting some legal advice, either free or some other way, is huge because most of them go it alone. They can't, you know, if they're already in foreclosure or whatever, they can't hire an attorney. But sometimes they just have to really seek out any sort of, you know, attorney-type advice if there's a free one or a discount one or something because that's what they're suffering from. They feel like they just can't afford it. And in a way, they almost can't not afford it, you know?
Yeah, thanks for that. I think I mean, that's the reality of people are really at a disadvantage, and this is sort of very technical kind of information that's thrown at people, and they're already pretty stressed about a number of other things too.
And this is Peggy. I think knowing all this really helps me keep my game face on, because in the last few months I've met with people that they've brought in their 1099 with their debt forgiveness on there, so I know what it is and what they're talking about. I've had some people who had a seizure of assets where the sheriff came in and just started taking stuff out of their house. So at least I can keep up to speed and I know what they're trying to tell me and what they're recovering from when we start looking at, okay, where's their budget at now? So, well, and Michael knows because I'm always bugging him about this stuff. So I think it's just good to be aware of what people are dealing with.
So, Peggy, are there lingering issues that we didn't cover here that you think are important to get on the table?
Well, I think your brief covers a lot of that. I know a lot. Some of the confusion that I see in how much debt people owe, or especially when it shows up in a collections and a credit report, is, you know, them trying to figure out what was their original debt and what is all the interest and the late fees and the service charges and all that stuff added on. So there's just a lot of confusion out there about how much they actually do owe. And the more information people have about their debt, the more they can, if they're trying to bargain with a collection agency, the more empowered they feel. So I guess I see that a lot. And then there's also some confusion about the difference between, like, the legal aspects of debt and what shows up on a credit report. You know, like you mentioned, how long it shows up on a credit report is one thing, but they can always come back and try to get the money from you at any time. I guess those are a few things I see.
Anybody else have any questions or observations?
This is Peggy Nordgren from Taylor County. I think it's fascinating that you can, if you need to go through bankruptcy to take care of bad debts, you need $1,000 or more to pay the attorney first. And people have to come up with that ahead of time. I think that's interesting. I also didn't know about the tax being taxed. It makes sense to me, but boy, oh boy, that's going to be a shock to people. But the other observation I have is people who are in big-time debt and haven't been paying their bills for a long time don't have the records, basically, or don't understand the records that they have that talks about their debt. And it's way overwhelming for them. They can't figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how we can help with that, but...
Yeah, it's a little late by the time you see them, right?
I mean, record keeping is so important for the people that we talk to in financial education or financial literacy. We cannot not talk about that because it's real important that people know what to keep and what not to keep.
I'm even feeling that right now during my taxes. I wish I had better organized myself.
And I concur with Peggy about the record keeping because I've worked with people where that 30-day verification period has passed and they have no idea if they still owe the debt or how much they did owe or where it was from. And the collection agency isn't required to give them anything, so they're just at their mercy. You know, maybe they've moved a few times, so there's just no record whatsoever.
I also find that people kind of grasp at things that aren't important. Like the question I get is, can a collection agency call me after 8 or after 9? You know what I mean? Okay, that's a rule, okay, but that's not the most important thing here. I get a lot of that.
So, Michael, what is your opinion on people sending a letter to a collection agency, you know, that's maybe calling once or twice a day saying that they don't want phone calls anymore?
You know, they're just doing that to get them off their back, or are they coming up with a plan to repay?
Well, the people I see don't have any money to repay, and they're barely making their basic living expenses.
Yeah.
So, I mean, their letter should say that in there, you know, that they don't have any money at this point, and if they do, they would get in touch with them, but don't call. Because I know before we've talked about, well, that's just opening yourself up to lawsuits, but if they don't have anything to garnish, meanwhile, anyway. So I'm wondering what you've seen with that on both sides.
Not much. I mean, I think most people tend to just ignore it until there's some court action. I don't think there's any harm in it, but it may not actually help.
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking about those people who are just in tears because they're being hounded by phone calls.
Right. I mean, obviously, if there's any sense that it's abusive and violates the act, then, you know, letting the collector know that you may make a filing might help. You know, make a complaint under the FTC or DFI. So that will help in terms of the harassment. But, you know, if what they're doing is within the bounds of the law, I think short of court action, there's probably not a whole lot they can do unless they're willing to, you know, come up with a plan to repay. And if they don't have the money to repay, then, you know, probably they're looking into garnishment or judgment situation.
Yeah, I guess I was just thinking about the just their right to have the phone call stop.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely stop at work if that's happening.
Yeah, I think you've asked me this before, if they're allowed to call at work. And I think that they can't, so they can request, so that is one where the law does give them some clear harbor. So they can say to a creditor, do not call me at work. If you know, you continue to harass me at home, but you can't call me at work. And I think that is a place where if they continue to call at work after that request has been made, that would be a violation under the Act.
I believe so. I think it's talked about in that debt collection book.
Yeah. So that is a safe harbor in terms of calls at work, but in terms of calls at all, you know, the law does give them the ability to call at home. Any other? Okay. Well, as always, just let me know both what other follow-up you might have on this particular topic and on other topics that you think might be of interest or, you know, important for us to consider in the future. I will just reiterate again, this is my best attempt as a non-attorney to address some of these issues. You know, one thing we might think about in the future is actually getting somebody with a consumer law background to give us more advice.
Michael, there will be somebody speaking at the Pathways Conference.
Oh, good. Good segue.
A consumer law attorney, David Dudley, out of Madison.
So it'll be one of the sessions at Pathways?
Correct.
Excellent. So that might be a good way for us to learn more about these topics as well. All right, well, just to remind everybody that Building Bucks is next Monday, and then next month we're going to get into quite a different topic, thinking about retirement rules of thumb. So, you know, what are those sort of shorthands that we can use to think about how much to have in retirement and think about retirement planning? Not as necessarily an expert advisor, even for ourselves, and think about what are the sort of research evidence-based practices that we have out there. So thanks, everybody. I appreciate it, and have a great Valentine's Day.